counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million, if I had $1 million, well, I'd buy you a house. I would buy you a
Hello and welcome to Sykes and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. Andrew on the board. I think we're live. I don't know why S&P futures are up 22. NASDAQ futures up 104. This is after pretty wobbly labor numbers yesterday. The two-month labor number, so sort of an odd day that we've got. I don't know if we're going to get them again on the first week of January or what. I haven't looked at that. I probably should have. We have gold and silver going to the moon here as we've got some kind of blockade going on in Venezuela. Not sure what that's all about, but let's see what it's doing to oil. Well, it was up $1.14, but it's still only 56.41, so it's really not doing much to the oil situation. But do we have Professor Kevin?
Yeah, you do, and I also think we're live. I'm hopeful anyway.
Yeah. Well, one part of the board was when Andrew goes to talk to me, that little switch might need a little work. But the last time we had the board and did a fix-it guy, he said, don't ever bring it back. So.
Yeah, well, I could see the exchange going along the lines of, is this Stocks and Jocks?
Yeah, well,
no, it's Iowa.
Yeah, it could be. We could be from Iowa. You know, Captain Kirk was from Iowa. You know, I don't know if you knew that or not.
You know where I got that? What movie line I'm stealing?
No, but one of my guys used to trade for me.
Field of Dreams. Is this heaven?
Yeah.
No, it's Iowa.
God. Wait,
I when that came out, my boss, the president of the bank where I worked, Arnie Weaver, he was an Iowa native, and he just loved that line.
Oh,
is this heaven? No, it's Iowa.
We had a guy used to trade for me. Tim Danick was his name. Nice guy. Now he's in the construction business. He, of course, his acronym was MUG, so he was known as Mugged Everybody, as you can only imagine.
Got it, yeah.
Guy hit the bleep out of the softball. Serious softball player. And when somebody said something like really stupid, he'd say, what are you, from Iowa? I'd look at him like, what do you mean, am I from Iowa or something? Tim was a funny guy. What do you think of those? I don't know if you're listening to the.
How? Does he amuse you? Does he?
But he just, wherever you were with him, you had a good time. Just one of those kind of dudes.
Okay.
We had a couple of guys from, this is going to sound so bizarre. But this was the day, Kevin. Sometime, once in a while, you know, you have to remember we go for a few cocktails, imagine that, over at Broker's Inn before it was torn down for the new Board of Trade floor that they don't need. And there's these guys in the next booth from China or Japan or someplace. I mean, I suppose I should be able to tell the difference, but they're sitting there, so Mugs starts talking to these guys, and they said something about, what are you guys, and one of the girls who traded for us, one of the girls, Rosemary, she was absolutely delightful. She's sitting there. So Mugs says, you guys got to try these shots we have over here. And they go, what's that? Remember those blowjob shots with the whipped cream on top or something? You ever have one of those?
I'll take your word for that one.
Well, the idea was, is this family radio? They have these big, huge shot glasses over there, right? Not the little ones, but the real big ones. So the idea is you put, I don't know, some vodka, and then, I don't know what you put on top of cream, to something. Then you put a thing of whipped cream on it. And the idea is to pick it up only with your mouth and slug it down without using your hands.
Okay, so there's ritual to it.
Yeah,
okay.
Well, the idea is, no matter what you do, you got like the whipped cream and stuff all over your face. Hence the name.
Yeah, hence the name. And were the guys better at it than the women?
Well, let's put it this way: the guys from Japan couldn't do it at all, and they kept saying "mouth too small, mouth too small." And Muggs doing one after another. Of course, Rosemary had no problem with it at all. And I'm thinking, whoa. I had no chance. I couldn't.
Rosemary, can I take you home?
Yeah, really. I mean, well, there's a lot of reasons to take her home. Terrific lady. Was a really, you know, she was a great broker. She would broker for us, and she could stand around all day long, never make a mistake. I mean, she was just terrific. And most of the ladies that came to the trading floor early were more brokers than market makers. Robin was one of the first market makers. I backed Sharon King, who was the first black lady market maker. But a lot of them were brokers. Brokers meaning you did trades for other people. There actually was a delineation in this world before we kind of screwed it all up, because you had to separate principal and agent. In other words, if PTI was a brokerage firm, that's what we did in any crowd. I mean, we would do your trades. We'd give somebody your order. And our broker, because Audrey was our broker for a while, we had Hoagie was our broker. They were in that crowd. They would do the trade, and they would say, you know, 45 calls, eighth of quarter. You know, they'd say, okay, I'll buy 10 from you. You were first, so that's what the broker did. His job was to get you the best price. And the other people made markets. They were competing market makers. This is so simple and so intelligent, Kevin. Of course, we don't have anything like that now. Now the broker doesn't charge allegedly, and then sells your order flow to somebody who wants it. So the people who are actually paying your broker are the people he's shopping your order to, and the guys who want it and trading ahead of it. It's, I don't know how we got there in this world. Well, that's kind of my theme this morning. I want to talk about two things. Yesterday we talked about on the show, and I know you were listening. I think you were listening for most of it. First of all, what did you think of the labor numbers? And I admit to being absolutely stunned by those shipbuilding numbers that I sent out to everybody. I knew that the industry had gone downhill and we hadn't made tankers in a long time and stuff, but I had zero idea that we're like 0.5% of world's production now, including like naval vessels. I mean, how do you let an industry like that go down, and how do you resurrect it? And what is the danger to all the people that are around those kinds of communities when those things go out of business? They talked about the place in Wisconsin that in order for three frigates. I have to believe we need three frigates. Well, somebody decides to cut it to one. I don't know if it was Biden, Trump, who the hell. We don't need those stinking frigates. We lay off the 93 people. Where do you get 93 people 5 years from now that you decide you need frigates with that skill set?
You know, well, by the that Tom is similar to what you've discussed. Your conversation with the younger Mayor Daley about CTA cars.
Yeah.
It doesn't take even a lot of vision, but it takes a little bit of vision to say, you know, I have a fleet, and the fleet we need to cycle through there, cycle out the old, and cycle in the new. On some kind of basis. I don't know, you know, when it comes to shipbuilding, I don't know if that's every 10 years, you know, or every year we're going to take the 20-year-old stuff out of commission and put something else in. Whatever it is, you can't run a business with such variability in the demand. When it's down, you're going to be stressed. When it's up, you're not going to be able to meet the demand. And so, you know, government is, in this case, government is being very, very stupid about how they manage the industry. How they provide business to the industry so that the industry can satisfy their needs. And so, and because so much of government is the accounting is on a cash basis, they have an incentive to try and divert funding away from everything else. Whereas, you know, I mean, heck, for silly things, for computers, for servers, for things like that, that I always had as three-year properties on the books, I was cycling out a third of the fleet every year just to make sure that my depreciation line was straight line, or maybe if I was growing, slightly up. Because when you hit that period in business, when you hit that period where there is zero depreciation, you're using something longer than the book life on it. Everybody loves it when that drops, But boy, when it comes back a year or two later, and you're putting this new depreciation expense on there, everybody hates it. So, you know, you really, you know, it's smart management anywhere to try and keep a steady line, a steady replacement line on there. And so that, you know, that makes a lot of sense, but we don't do it that way. So I think that's a big part of the problem. As far as the labor numbers, I don't know if you look at the ISM report every
I see it, but I don't make a... It's not really a market mover, Kevin, but
no,
they are important. That part I get.
Yeah, it's a pulse of what's going on. Well, the November manufacturing report, I mean, basically in a nutshell, new orders contracting, production expanding, employment contracting, supplier deliveries faster.
Kevin, is this a national one, or is this the individual feds, like the Philly Fed and the, what's they calling the
oh,
one?
No, this is their national survey manufacturing activity. So again, new orders contracting, production expanding, employment contracting, supplier deliveries faster, raw materials inventories contracting, customers inventories too low, prices increasing, exports and imports contracting. That's kind of a weird mixed bag of what's going on in the manufacturing industry.
Makes you wonder if you believe the one that's expanding. How could it possibly be?
Which one? Production?
Yeah.
Well, what's that telling you? It's telling you if customer inventories are too low, then production would be expanding to fill it. But if production inventories are low because their demand plan says it ain't going to happen, or, you know, we're not going to see the activity, then production expanding means inevitably it's going to contract because we're going to be overloading the supply chain. So when it contracts, then that'll mean employment is already contracting. So I don't know. You know, we have to put those two together. When you say employment contracting and production expanding, is that productivity? Is that more automation? You know, what's going on there is the question. And that requires a little bit deeper dive. But this I think gives you a little bit of insight about what to expect over the next several months at any rate. But it's really a mixed bag of what the manufacturing activity looks like. Now, on the other hand, we can go back to the services and look at the services.
Well, one of these days we're going to stop hiring people, overhead people in the healthcare industry, and then what's going to happen? Nothing? We got nobody hiring?
Yeah, the healthcare report doesn't show up anymore on their page. Which was always interesting because that was the one that was always thriving.
Carl dug it out from somewhere. It was in the
services. On the other hand, you know, their business activity is up. Their new orders are up. For services, the employment is down, and supplier deliveries, their delivery index is up, which is delivery of services. So that's kind of interesting that employment is down. So in the case of services deliveries, you're probably seeing, a lot of office type of productivity that is taking place. And that makes sense with my sense of what we will loosely call the AI market. And as I've told you, that AI right now, the state of AI is that it's doing pretty much what a human can do. It's just doing it way, way faster. It's not really artificial intelligence. It's just a higher degree of automation, and it's found its way into the offices, whereas historically automation has been on the production side, and the jobs that have been most affected by automation have been production type of jobs, manufacturing and warehousing and so on, where now that's reaching into functions like demand planning, route optimization, those kinds of things. So the money in that sector, as far as I'm concerned, is in the applications of the technology, and more so than it is in the technology itself.
Well, I guess, but I mean, my issue with that, and I sure as hell don't have any numbers or just have a sense that we talk about the service industry. The service industry has to service something. You can't service nothing.
I mean, I understand. Yeah. Yeah, well, there's only so much we're going to be able to do. There is in here somewhere, there's a list, and I have to find it, of the industries that are expanding and that aren't. But at any rate, you know, I do recommend it, and this would be for the listeners, you know, look at the ISM report every month, because it does give you some insight into what's going on in the economy.
Is that a totally different survey than the Philly Fed, and then what's the one in the
middle? Oh, yeah, it's an independent organization, the Institute for Supply Management.
And then, they do a service one, too, right? They do the manufacturing and the service?
Yeah, they have manufacturing and services.
Well, I think, you know, out of all the people that are on the show, other than me, you have more of a sense of what's going on every day than most. Probably Carl does too. But it's funny how we kind of gone from topic to topic, and how they just keep expanding as somebody does a little bit of work. Could be me, could be Hal. Lately, it's been Hal doing a lot of it, and Carl always does a lot. You dig up a subject, and all of a sudden you start digging on it a little bit, and then you sit there and go, boy, this just keeps expanding like throwing a rock in a pond. I'd like today, somehow, between you and Russell and Alyssa, if she calls in, is what is the sense of, I beat up on railroad cars all the time, but I guess what Kevin and I are trying to say is, I don't think, even though UPS doesn't seem to be a very well-run place these days, I don't think that UPS buys 5,000 trucks, and then all of a sudden, 20 years later, they go, oh, man, these are all falling apart. We better get another 5,000. I mean, I don't know what the guys at General Motors, what have they been doing for 19 years after they all got laid off?
What have you noticed about Amazon delivery trucks lately?
They all look the same. I mean, they're all kind of new. They're here. They just kind of started here, but...
Did you notice that, you know, maybe 3 months ago now, something like that, all of a sudden every single one of them is electric?
Really, I wonder if that's good or bad.
Well, it's very much an Amazon thing to do, because how are road taxes paid?
Yeah,
out of gasoline.
That's another. Why are we not dealing with that?
Well, we gave a major incentive for people to switch over to...
But the states never did.
Sooner or later, they're going to have some kind of mileage chart for road taxes, a use tax. I mean, because basically, doing it through the gasoline pump is a usage tax. So they're going to have to come up with a different one. I bet you when they put on the mileage tax, they don't take off the gasoline tax.
Kevin and I are not 25 anymore, but there is a certain logic to this.
I know. I know that when I wake up every morning.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, it's funny, in the trucking industry, I was in that for a little while when I worked for ICX. I was a guy in the dock, but I knew the guy who ran the place. He lived two doors down, and actually my brother married his daughter. So we were good friends. And I learned a lot about the trucking industry from him. He'd come over, and we'd BS in the backyard for a couple hours. He's a very social guy. And even in those days, we're talking the 70s, you have a tax whenever you buy diesel, right? All right, so if you look at an over-the-road truck, even then, where they didn't do as good a mileage as now, you could have filled up at the ICX place, you know. Those things held, 300 gallons or something, Kevin? You could have filled up and made it all the way across Illinois and Iowa without buying any gas. Well, you couldn't do that. They pulled you over to go, wait a minute, this state has a certain amount of miles. You need to buy that amount of gas here. And if you don't want to buy it, here's like a coupon. You send in the tax for it. I mean, and now all of a sudden we've got this massive industry of electric cars. And, oh, by the way, we used to have, a lot of, we still have, obviously, online buying where people didn't pay taxes online for a decade. Are they getting paid, Kevin, or are they that stupid? I don't know which is worse. How come people 50 years ago figured this out? Wait a minute. You can't just fill up in the state over there where there's no tax and come through here without giving us something. Now, does that mean the people now are getting greased by the electric car industry? They can't be that dumb, even if they're politicians. Now, politicians have a huge skill set, and the fact that they get elected, that you and I never could, because we don't seem to have that skill set, but nor maybe do we want it. But this reaches the point of stupidity, doesn't it? I mean, it's some point here.
Let's at least call it not rational.
Yeah, I mean, how do you? I mean, no, you can't. I know your tank gets you across Iowa, dummy, but the law says you got to buy gas here. I don't care if you buy it here or not. You're giving us the taxes if you did. Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? I'm not saying I want people paying taxes, but you know where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
But, I mean, how do you... I don't even know, other than, like, a war, which we sure as hell don't want, how do you restart an industry? Because I had a long conversation last time Bill Moriarty was in. We talked about, he said, you know, and Bill has had he's really had a nice career, and he loved it, in civil engineering, and he got out of the roadside. He did that when he was young, but he got into water treatment, and he really thought that was terrific. So he's water treatment plants and those kinds of things. And he can tell you, well, he's been on the air, he can tell you chapter and verse of, like, every part of the country, where they get their water from, how much it costs, this and that. And, it was a terrific career for him. He got to move around and so forth, go from different places, build a place, and he says now, you know, it's not considered a sexy career. I mean, what would have to happen? I mean, and living on the south side of Chicago and seeing all the people in my parents' age, a lot of them work for all these factories. And, Kevin, every single one, maybe not every single one, but pretty damn every single one, somehow went out of business, went overseas, screwed the living bejesus out of the employees to the best they could. Somehow or another with takeovers and stealing the pension plans, and I could rattle off the stories of 10 firms that would make people sick. Just the thought of your son or daughter going in railroad car building, where you know it's, oh, I need 500 subway cars, by the way, I don't need another for 30 years, you're laid off for 30 years. I can't imagine somebody wanting to be in the shipbuilding industry as a career, and yet, boy, I would love to do it. I mean, imagine people hauling in some truckloads of steel, and 2 years later, some beautiful ship pops in the water, and you were part of that? I mean, is there any incentive? What would have to happen at your school if all of a sudden somebody decided to put a huge shipbuilding thing in Gary or someplace, or in Michigan City or something? I mean,
we do respond to that kind of stuff, you know, much like we did to data centers.
Yeah, but who would teach the course?
We do a great one for it. Well, and I was going to say, as you talked about that, how do you get it started? I think that's part of what is behind trying to draw all this foreign investment into the United States, say you know how to do shipbuilding, so we want you to invest in that, but we want your expertise as well. I think that's part of what's behind that that particular policy. So we keep seeing it, and thinking, we should just be investing U.S. money, but you've got to give somebody an incentive to bring their expertise into the country as well.
Yeah, I don't really know the nuts and bolts of how far gone we are. I don't think you need a Chinese firm to take over the place in Wisconsin that had the expertise to build three frigates, and you just canceled two of them. I have to believe that they have the expertise. Or this whole idea of everything is a big deal just makes me very nervous. And I'm not saying it's only because Trump does it, but it's going on here for a long time. I don't trust it, Kevin. I don't trust that the rail car business, when they built the building Chicago subway cars, I surely don't trust it on the Bay Bridge. I don't know if you remember that one where what was the bid? $400 million and ended up being $6 billion or something. I don't trust it at all, this foreign investment stuff.
Yeah, I think the appropriate attitude is show me. Let's see it happen before we say, oh, goody.
Well, plus I don't like the government taking a piece of it. I don't know who's getting greased. I mean, I don't really think we needed a foreign company to take over U.S. Steel. If U.S. Steel is a going concern, and we had Bob on here, talked about it, he goes, if U.S. Steel died tomorrow, nobody cared. There's all kinds of other places here. But now because it has the name U.S. on it, now all of a sudden, we've got somebody in governments on the board or something, or they're part of the stockholders. Maybe that could work, Kevin. I, it seems like a direction we don't necessarily have to go.
It's definitely a direction I don't want to go, and, you know, and I don't want to go that way anymore now than, you know, back when we did the auto industry bailout and put, you know, and the government controlled the board of General Motors.
The Chrysler one didn't bother me so much. The General Motors thing was a little weirder.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was. We need, you know, there's a fine line between the government supporting business climate and supporting certain industries, and then getting in the way. And government has a really good a way of getting in the way. They did that on the CHIPS Act.
Yeah.
The restrictions that they put on businesses to get involved in that was ridiculous.
Well, I remember there's always a million questions, Kevin, and that's why, obviously, I love doing the show, because with the people we have on here, even a lot of us would disagree on some stuff, but we all kind of want to ask the next question, which appears to be so rare, doesn't it? I mean, you listen to the speech, the Fed news conferences, and you sit there, God, these people are morons. I mean, but I'm sure they're not, but they just, either they're not going to want to ask them, right? Anyway, when you look at... Remember, we all remember 9/11, and the airlines were basically shut down for, what, like a month or something? And you look at United Airlines, and didn't the government have to bail everybody out there? They pretty much did, didn't they? Didn't they pay the pilots' salaries for a while or something? There's been so many of these bailouts, it's hard to remember, but they definitely helped out. And I'm sitting there going, wait a minute. The United Airlines has been in business for 65 years. They're out of business 2 weeks and they go under. I mean, where's the planning there?
Boy, you must be operating on really thin margins.
But I mean, that's that's jumping to their defense. You say the margins are low. Okay, well, maybe they are. Yet, since then, when did I do this? 9/11 was what, 2001? I think in 2000, I went back, and I don't know where I got all this information, Kevin. I mean, I'm sure I lost it, but I went back every single... Since 2001, United had, like, the best 19 years of their life. And at the end of the day, they had almost no more retained earnings than when they started. They paid it all out in bonuses, and they... I don't think they owned... If they owned a plane, it was by accident. You know, and they bring in this money, and if you and I were on the board, and they made $1 billion 1 year in cash flow, you and I might say, you know, this next plane for $330 million, why don't we just write the friggin' check? Can you imagine how unpopular we would be on that board? Why? I mean, you would think that over the 20-year period that they would own, you know, now 20% of their planes, or 30%. They don't want every part of it. And every single one is leased to the max. I mean, I don't get it. I mean, you would think you'd want some sort of a balance sheet to protect you. They don't. It all just goes flying out to God knows where. And at the end of the day, if it happened again tomorrow, it's knock on wood, it doesn't. Guess what? They're in the same boat. I mean, we make these people into cartels.
Theoretically, you know, by leasing, they haven't written any of the big checks for any of this stuff. So theoretically, they should have a pretty good cash reserve because they haven't committed their cash to capital.
Except they don't. That's the problem.
And they don't, which is, I don't necessarily need them to, you know, need to see any corporation just holding large amounts of cash, because that isn't earning anything. But they should have it in investments. They should be able to liquidate if they need to. That would just, to me, that would just be sensible, management of your balance sheet.
We give these people, or let's put it this way, it's sort of a cartel. Try and get a gated O'Hare or a Dulles, even if they're not using them. Try and get one. I mean, it's sort of a cartel. It's a preferred industry, autos, airlines, you name it. Certainly, airline and Boeing. And yet, at the end of the day, if they're so stretched that we have to bail them out, they should be so strong with all the perks they're getting Of course, then again, every municipality taxes the hell out of them, right? So if you if they have any extra money, people go ahead and tax it from them. So it's not all one way either. I mean, right? I mean, if you stay overnight at O'Hare, that's why they can't wait to get the planes out of there at night, right? The Chicago charges them so much. Doesn't a couple of places in Colorado, they stopped going there because the overnight parking for the plane was so much money? So everybody's got their finger out or their thumb in a pie. But just, it seems like there's no common sense all along. We wonder when things go bad, Kevin. It just, why do we wonder so much?
Well, what was it? Wasn't it just a day or two ago? You had Brandon Johnson out there saying, "Oh no, no businesses don't leave just because of a little tax money."
Well, that's another. I mean, on the political side, you know, to me on both, the nicest thing I could say is the skill set needed to get the job seemingly is not matching the skill set you want in the job, and this is going on for probably since Abe Lincoln, right? I mean, Brandon Johnson has as much business being mayor as I do being a jockey. I mean, I'll just say that. He comes from an area where he's never had a job. He has no kind of, you give him a balance sheet. I mean, he's not a dumb man. It's not like he doesn't like Chicago, but just his background is you give money to certain people. They're the people you rely on. You know, somehow or another, the entire society's ills is throw more money at the school board, even though they're not producing students. And it's not all their fault, but God help us if we ever did a deep dive into why exactly, what are they dealing with, what's the drug problems, what's the family problems, what can we do to help that? What about the adults that couldn't help the kids with the homework? Could we possibly keep the school open at night where the adults that should have learned and didn't can come and actually learn? What about all the, you know, the technical schools? We're seeming we're trying to bring people back to Chicago to do technical stuff. Is there any place where you can learn how to weld or do electric? I'm thinking no. I mean, all the stuff that you need to have happen isn't happening. Just give us more money.
And you know what? And there are models. There are success models elsewhere in the United States where they've had all the same problems, and they have turned it around in not too many years. So, you know, it's there for anybody who, you know, who wants to know. But you get a lot of pushback because you know, the status quo comes with a power structure.
Well, all you have to do
in Nashville's case, what caused them to change their model was the state of Tennessee was about to take it over, take over the city school system. Well, you're going to lose your power anyway. We might as well find another way to do this.
Well, I'm going to my cousin, terrific guy, 91st birthday on Sunday. He's still totally with it. All you would have to do, Kevin, is buy him breakfast, bring a microphone, and ask him what Tilden Tech looked like when he went to Tilden Tech. And he would say, well, you had your people that wanted to go to college. You had your people that... They even had a garage there with a big airplane engine. You know, in those days, probably a propeller one. It says they had a class where you took the engine apart, put the engine back together, and learned all about aircraft. So if you left there, you could go right over to Midway Airport and become an aircraft engine mechanic if you wanted to be. Because we had all kinds of stuff. We had electric, we had engineering. I don't think, I mean, what do you need to go research? Just ask the guy, what did it used to look like? And look and see what it looks like now. And just notice the difference. I mean, for God's sake. I mean, how do we lose this?
Know what works. That's what's crazy. Have you heard of the Mississippi Miracle?
I have, but tell everybody.
Well, in Mississippi, the reading scores were so low, they were, you know, their all their scores across the board were among the worst in the United States. They embarked several years ago on a reading basics program, because that's the foundation for everything, and they have completely turned around education in their state. Now their scores for everything are near the top of the country, and Louisiana is doing the same thing, and they're climbing up the rankings in all of the standardized test scores as well. So, you know, it's like watching the Bears get better at blocking and tackling. See what happens.
Yeah, well, my mom used to, when she was, you know, grew up in the Depression, and she went to school in the neighborhood. She was kind of in the right at the time where the Great Migration was happening, so Inglewood High School was totally, you know, half black, half white. And, you know, and she would say, you know, Tom, I understand what these teachers are doing these days. And I go, what are you talking about? You know, we could talk like that. And she goes, it, the families now that are kind of broken apart, she goes, they're very similar to the families were in the Depression. Most of the parents, half of them couldn't even speak English. He said, you've got an 8-year-old for 5 hours a day. That's plenty. You don't need homework. He goes, you have to assume they're getting no help at home whatsoever. So they taught us how to cut our fingernails, our toenails. They taught us how to make sure we were clean. So, but if there was a reading assignment, you gave everybody the reading assignment. You sat there for a half hour while everybody read it. Then everybody had to maybe jot down a few things they remember from it. You discussed it. You couldn't assume for a second that you were going to get help at home. She goes, could you imagine grandpa or grandma helping me with my homework? And I go, no, I really can't. I mean, she goes, you have to act like what you have. She goes, you think people in the farm communities, you sent the kids to school, they sent kids home with homework, when the minute he got home, he had to clean the barn? She goes, you have somebody for 5 or 6 hours, and they're 10 years old. You should be able to deal with it right there. You don't need the family. I mean, you need them to show up. I mean, you know. But other than that, you have to act like your clients need you to act. You don't just act like you're in New Trier, for God's sake, when you're in Inglewood. You know.
Well, and you know what? I'm actually at the college level. I am noodling around with that, where. You know, this started because I have we have a business that sends us people. So I have a class, like today I have a class full of employees from one of the local businesses, and it's a quality management class. So they can work in teams on this. It really works out well where they bring in real projects, real quality issues. You know, so. You know, how, you know, scrap rate on making windows would be an example, where if you chip them or break them, you can't sell them. So, you know, how do you make sure you don't, in the production process, how do you make sure you don't chip them or break them? Or thermal pane windows, if you don't get a good seal and it goes through the sealing process and the seal's not good, then it's scrap. You can't do anything with it. And that's an expensive way to do business if you have too much of that. So they come in and they identify, you know, in some cases we'll identify several hundred thousand dollars worth of opportunity. In other cases, we will identify, you know, literally, you know, over $1 million worth of opportunity. And they'll, you know, take all the lean tools and do the analysis. And sometimes we'll get them all the way up to, you know, recommendations. Sometimes we'll just, you know, we'll get them to the analysis phase about what's wrong. And then they can come back and take project management from me and we'll talk about how they implement. But the my point for this is that the model for it, the education model, is that I can because I have them in class longer, I don't give them much homework. They have some opportunities to earn industry certifications, so I have them do that on their own. But it's not a lot of homework, and instead I have them for extra time, and we work on the projects in class. So, like today is the last day, so we invite all their management team in for and they present what they've done to the management group, which is pretty cool, and always, you know, they're always impressed. But all along, we've been blocking off class time to work on their projects. I have three groups, three projects, and so I'll bounce from one group to the next to see how they're doing, give them some guidance on some things, help them with the financials and all of that. But they really learn how to take these things apart. So when I bring that up and I describe it, because I'm thinking of doing all my classes that way, let me have you for an extra hour. So if it's a 3-hour class, let me have you for the fourth hour, but you're not going to have much homework.
Well, when I was, Pullman had a deal, and you and I think somewhat are on the same page on this government stuff, and I don't know if it's just politics or what it is, Kevin, but Australia, there's an outfit there, something Gonin and Company, and Pullman signed a deal with them. They wanted to build a push-pull car, I think similar to the Boston car that I was involved with. You know, people that see the cars here in Chicago, they're all, they look like they're double-decker, but they're not really. They're gallery cars. Okay, what the hell's a gallery car? If you look down the middle, it's open. There's seating on the side. So the car is not tall enough to be totally double-decker. So if somebody tall walks down the middle, he'd be banging his head on where the floor would be on the side. Okay, but enough of that. But the first push-pull car was made by the Erie Lackawannas. Actually, the first one was here. But then out east, sometimes there's tunnels, and you can't have a taller car, so they want a single level. Anyway, so Gonina decided that Pullman had made one of these. So they signed a licensing agreement with Pullman because they wanted to make them themselves. But the deal was we had a guy in the production, in the fabrication department, went over there for 6 months as a consultant. And Bob Johnson went over for 6 months as a project manager. And somebody went after that for like a production guy or something. So they were able to, two firms could get together, cut some kind of a deal, and say, you guys have the expertise. We need a couple of guys. We need some your drawings, blah, blah, blah. And they paid Pullman for it. Why all of a sudden, if there's a ship being made in South Korea, can't somebody here, without fanfare, without the government grabbing a piece of it, or somebody, the last two presidents, somebody in their family grabbing a piece of it, why can't they just do it, Kevin? I mean, it just is, because it makes sense. What do we need all this BS for? I don't get it.
Oh, you sure you do? You sure you get it?
Well, I get it, but I don't want to. I mean, why can't they just say, hey, Kevin, your outfit makes these terrific railroad cars. How about we license it, and you come on over and help us with the engineering and stuff, and we'll pay you. But we want our people here to make it, and we want to learn from them. And you say, okay, well, what's the problem with that? Why do we need, you know, 15 mayors and governors and everybody else, their finger in the pie?
Oh, but apparently we do.
Yeah, apparently someone. But I guess back to the original question, what's it going to take for somebody? I mean, obviously if there's jobs there and they're paying decently, people probably jump in, but... And like I said, on the South Side, when Bill was on, he all he did was talk about everybody's parents who were in one of these manufacturing facilities and saw how people were being downsized and screwed, closed, and God knows what else. They swore in a stack of Bibles that their kids would never be in an industry like that. Not because the work was dirty or any of those kinds of things. They actually probably liked what they did. But how do you break that? I mean, I can't imagine if I had a kid going to Purdue or wherever right now saying, boy, you want to be a mechanical engineer, or like Bill Moriarty said, nobody wants to be a civil engineer. How do you make that an idea that it's going to be a rewarding career, that for the next 70 years, by the way, we're going to be building ships here. I think we're going to still need ships 70 years from now. I mean, how do you turn that bus around psychologically?
Well, I believe, and again, I go back to, you know, this is part of the Nashville model. First of all, you have to expose kids to careers. I just read something last week, and it was like career day at school. And so the parents were coming in, and you had the bankers and the lawyers and, you know, the professional people, and the kids were totally bored by this. And then the dad, who was an electrician, came in, and he had tools and all kinds of stuff, you know, all that. And the kids were all over it. They loved it. And they were totally totally into learning more about it. So I think you have what's your inclination becomes the issue. What do you like? And you have to expose kids to all kinds of careers. Now, I do think that's turning a lot. There are a lot of people that are moving away from the notion that everybody should go to college and everybody should be doing office work. There's a whole lot of movement away from that, and a lot of movement towards entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurship programs are very, very popular now. People want to start them up, but they're not starting them up to become, AI consultants or something like that. They're starting them up to be electricians, to be bakers, to be, you know, whatever they want, you know, whatever it is that interests them. So I think you have to expose kids to careers that are and you have to be getting them as seventh graders, eighth graders, and so on. That doesn't mean they have to lock into a career by the time they're in high school, but a lot of them, by the time they're juniors in high school, are pretty focused on a career because they've been exposed to so much. They see what they really, really like and what really, you know, what they enjoy doing, and they move that in that direction. It just takes a little, you know, you just have to be intentional about it. Now, you know, we go back and, you know, I always had this as a criticism of the Obama administration, not in any nefarious way, but President Obama was a very, very big advocate of everybody should go to college. And so they tried to make policy around that, subsidizing college, or, you know, all the things that they did that have, frankly, have made education more expensive. It's not, you know, it's not a bargain, and that pushed a lot of people into college debt that are now, you know, struggling with it. So, you know, it hasn't turned out well as far as I'm concerned. But that was the philosophy. I think we're getting away from that philosophy. There are a lot of people moving away from college attendance, or, you know, something that's other than a...
Well, when you say that, though, I would...
Other than a degree in... other than a four-year degree, that there's a lot of people moving into other kinds of certifications, other kinds of academic pursuits, that... And I think that makes sense for a lot of people.
Well, you're what you're saying, though, and I'll try and interpret this for myself. I think the idea that education... After high school, I'm all for it. Obviously, I did 6 years of it, and I don't think I wasted a day. But in our day, why wouldn't you go to Notre Dame, Illinois, for $3,000 a year, get you out of the house, you learn to live with other people, and it was cost effective, and you learn something. And, oh, by the way, an awful lot of people took mechanical engineering, chemical engineering, pre-med. I mean, it wasn't like everybody was there, you know, learning how to work in an office. I mean, I would say that the business school was what? Was it even a third of the place? I don't think so. But I'm saying now, because the cost part, and there's all kinds of knaves in there, the universities being, you know, the biggest benefactor, the all the different ways to get there that you work on and you bring up and you work at, you're right. I mean, there's no doubt that every single guy piling out of high school just to be shoved into college at $80,000 a year is probably the wrong, unless he knows he's going to be a doctor and wants to be in pre-med, and even that, he probably could go to somewhere else for a couple of years. The whole experience that you and I had, people are being priced out of it. It doesn't mean that it was bad.
I'm not saying it was bad. I'm just saying it wasn't a good financial deal.
Well, it was for us.
Yeah, and I don't, you know, I deal with a lot of people who have college degrees, and they're working in factories.
I see no problem with that. I have no problem with that.
Yeah, so, you know, I see that, too.
Well, you can do that at 75 or 80 grand. You can't do it at 300 grand.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, I mean, one of our friends... his dad owned a big fence company in Detroit, and he was going to go back and run the fence company. Why can't he get an arts and letters degree? Why can't he get an accounting degree? He's got to run the place. I mean, what's the matter with knowing something? Why couldn't he get a mechanical engineering degree? You know, it's funny. The guy from Belden Brick, for those that don't know, it provided the brick for every single building at Notre Dame, except for one. Can you name it, Kevin?
Probably the stadium expansion.
No. It's the new golf course, because Lou Holtz had a buddy, and he screwed the building brick out of the deal. Anyway, but now they've been making brick for, you know, how many generations, and Dick Belden was telling me the brick now is better than it ever has been, because one of the kids went somewhere for chemical engineering or something, and he's introduced some new stuff into the processes. He goes, they used to last 200 years, now they're going to last 300. I mean, so it's not like just because you're going to run a brick company, you can't learn something. I mean, I think education, well, I come from a family. My mother was, 2 years before she died, she was still taking history classes at St. Xavier's at night. I mean, so.
I have no problem with that line of thinking at all. What I am saying, though, is that a lot of times you know, vocational training is more appropriate. And a lot of times, you know, I think you'll find that, you know, one, it may, that makes more financial sense for people, but it also aligns with what people enjoy doing. And I think we've told them, no, you will never enjoy that. As you said before, there are a lot of parents who said, no, I just don't want my kids working in the factories anymore. I worked in the factories and it was hard work. But factories and warehouses and, you know, distribution centers are not what they used to be. Some are. Some are dirty, you know, dirty old line manufacturing companies. But and very, you know, hard labor type of intensive. But there's a whole lot that are, you know, they've embraced automation, but they've also embraced, you know, the lean initiatives that make it a cleaner, more streamlined place to work. And they need people who, one, understand that, understand how all that works, which is what I do. And they also need people who take a lot of pride in what they make and have a lot of pride of workmanship in what they do. And, you know, you have to build that into your process, when you're operating a manufacturing business. That's how you make great products, and so you have to build that in. But, you know, at the same time, you just can't, if you want people to stay. Was it you that you were talking about turnover? Who we were talking about turnover with this week?
We were talking about it. Who was that? But, you know, but I want you're saying, Kevin, I don't sense, I mean, again, it's a small sample, I don't sense the people's parents that I knew pissed off at the job they had or what they were making. They were pissed off at what happened to the, somebody bought the place out, closed it, and 500 people out on the street who lived in the same neighborhood the same day. That was where all the edge came from. It wasn't from the job itself. It was just all of a sudden, everybody's pension they thought they had, they're screwed out of because somebody bought them. And, you know, it had to do with how those industries all closed and what happened to them and what it did to the neighborhood. It wasn't that the job sucked.
Well, and you know what, I see it differently. I see a lot of people whose jobs did suck. It was hard. It was really hard. Oh, well, you know, work.
Hey, welding for 8 hours is a big deal.
Yeah. But on the other hand, there are people who really, really love doing it, love being really, really good at it, and so, you know, why not? All I'm saying is, yes, I'm not saying we should never teach anybody to be an accountant, to be an attorney, to be anything, you know. And in manufacturing businesses, you need people that are just as adept at purchasing and demand planning and, you know, their economic models and, you know, you need everything. But we've steered people away from the stuff that requires you to get your hands on it. We've done that over the years, and I think that's snapping back.
Well, I think it is, and I think it's enjoyable to actually make stuff. I mean,
Yeah, like I said, pride of workmanship is a huge deal.
But I mean, but getting something started is always. I would like to see if somebody has a particular type of ship. What do you suppose? You know, the numbers are tossing around though, Kevin. I mean, with some of the AI numbers we tossed around the other day, this is another subject, maybe we'll talk about it on Friday, but that article I sent about how much borrowing there was going on for this AI construction. Kevin, it wasn't that long ago, and you and I talked, how many shows did we talk about people doing the cloud build-outs with the big, huge places? Did any of those things ever get done? I know the one up where in Northbrook or something was the first one. Are there any, I mean... But this is a Friday discussion. But
Amazon has an AWS center that they just opened here.
But I'm saying, you know, the idea that, you know, we're talking trillions of dollars are going into this, and some of these loans, we'll talk about this on Friday, because there's an article that talks about slicing the loans up, and God, it sounds just like the mortgage crap in 2007, Kevin, where they're all off balance sheet and everybody's taking a piece, and they're selling smaller banks and people, you know, a slice of an AI loan of, you know, $2 billion, you're getting your piece, and you're supposed to get this. And it sounds just like the mortgage crap. I hope it doesn't end the same way. But why does this stuff never change, for God's sake? same way of screwing people out of their dough. It's and what they're doing now is the again, this is Friday's discussion. What is it? 150% leverage. So if you think the plant's going to cost you $3 billion, you're borrowing 4.5. I'm going, what do you do with the other $1.5 billion? You pocket it? Kevin, this is like...
Well, yeah, so how much of it is leveraged? And we talked about accounting on that. You know, I will say cloud is foundational to AI.
Yep.
Nobody's building out their own infrastructure on that. They're taking cloud space and doing it that way. So, you know, it's really a foundational technology now. And so, you know, that part's important. But we're also seeing... we're seeing a lot of a lot of accounting gimmickry that I don't like at all. I know Carl's pointed it out on the air, and I think I've mentioned it a few times as well. If you put your properties on, we talked about it earlier about managing your depreciation expense by cycling through your fleet every 3 years or whatever. If you're putting things on the books and you're replacing them, sooner or later, once you pull something out of service and it has a book value, you have to write down that book value. That's going to come back and bite a lot of companies at some point. Well, either that, or you're just going to have to live with the asset you have, but it's not going to be competitive anymore.
Sort of like my old truck. I'm just living with it, right?
Yeah.
God. Well, we also have talked a little bit Friday. Last night I was with a bunch of younger people from the regulatory group over at the SIBO and OCC. Talk about people thinking, where's their life going to go? Are they still going to be in regulation at an exchange 30 years from now? They're not all that happy. It weren't the same as the people in my era where the next day maybe somebody would hire you on as a trader and you get to do something. Not that regulatory people don't do anything, but there's a lot of dead end stuff going on here, Kevin. And we keep talking about it. Maybe we can open somebody's eyes. Do we have Russell?
Yeah, you do have Russell. So I will right. Turn you
I'm
over
here.
To Professor Rhodes, and I'll be listening in. So I'll blast in all the
Before the you correct. Dash. One thing we did talk about last night, and Russell will opine on this. We'll flip to Russell on this one. Is amazing amount of people still think the bowl games are like they were 10 years ago. They don't...
Who thinks that?
A lot of people. I mean, I guess if it's on TV... I said,
Do they think college football is like it was 10 years ago?
I don't think they think that, but I said, none of them makes any money in these bowl games. I mean, there had to be a table of 7 people that are all fans. Not one of them knew that the school has a certain tickets they have to buy. You mean they got to buy tickets? Well, yeah. What do you think? If the school has alumni that travels and they can sell them, they're probably a winner in a bowl game. But if not, they're a stone cold loser. And we'll talk about that maybe on Friday. Russell, how are you? And
so we have
okay.
Just to throw out on that too, they're filling time. They're filling time on ESPN. It's cheap production, and it's in many cases now. They don't even send a broadcast team there. They just do it out of the office in Connecticut.
Yeah, John's brother Pete was doing that for a while. Some of the lower-level bowl games, he was like a color guy, and he just went to Connecticut, like you said.
All right. You guys have a good rest of the show. And I'll be in touch. Bye.
Russell, where's your sidekick?
I don't know. She's giving exams, et cetera.
Really, the nerve of her.
So,
I wanted to, next time she's on and we were having this, kind of a combo theme going on this week as we hit on the article about how we don't have any shipbuilding left in this country. And I knew it was down, but I had no idea. We were down to like 6 shipbuilding yards when China's got 300. And I had no idea it was that low. We're down to like, we're half of 1% of the world's shipbuilding now?
Luckily, we're much better at blowing them up than the Chinese are. So I think we're going to be okay.
God. And I don't
overly worry about that one. I've heard that thrown out there over and over again.
Well, from the ivory tower, and don't take that wrong. You look at it and you say, well, somehow it'll all correct. But me being in an industry like that, shutting a place down and 5 years later trying to start one up.
Oh, I know.
It's like
I think that's something we learned in COVID. was, you know, that oh, well, you know, those guys used to do that. Let's just ask them to do that because the supply chain's all screwed up. And then you find out it's not just like flipping a switch.
Well, I mean, if you tear down, can you imagine starting the thing having to build a huge dry dock just for starters?
I mean, no, and then you got to find the space.
Yeah. You got to be near water, you know, one would think.
And odds are half the places that used to be dry docks, et cetera, are like casinos or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, to get something started, I mean, I say this all the time, to get something started to build a railroad car would, you know, if I still had those kind of skills, it would take me 2, 3, 4 years probably.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine what it would take me to build any kind of sophisticated ship. And they're all sophisticated now. I'm not talking about a tanker. I'm talking about a frigate or a mine.
You're talking about building a high-rise on water.
Yeah, but that's
how I always kind of think about it. Because if you set one of those things on its side, it's a pretty tall building.
Yeah, and I mean, how do you... They were talking about the place in Wisconsin that they cut back from 3 to 1, and by the way, they laid off 93 people. I'm going, wait a minute. If those people all go get another job in another part of the country, and all of a sudden somebody decides, oh man, we really do need 3, you're not getting those people back.
No.
And I don't...
No, and even if, you know, they had a little bit of a desire to move back to where they were, they'd already be so angry from before, you'd really have to write them a nice check.
Well, that's right. That's kind of what we were talking about, is that especially from the South Side, where so many people worked in these manufacturing facilities or worked for the railroad servicing them or something, and all of a sudden they're just all out of work. And, oh, by the way, their pension, weren't we supposed to get a pension? Where the hell's our pension? Well, somebody stole your pension. I mean, the taste that was left of, you know, we need 1,000 people for 3 years, but then we need 10 people for 7 years, then we need 1,000 people again. That just doesn't hunt in today's world. People don't want to go to school for that.
But you end up in Starbucks. At least you have certainty there.
Well, some kind. Talk to Andrew about that, about your hours and stuff at those places. But obviously you're in the terrific business school down in Indiana. What is your sense of? Bill Moriarty was at.
By the way, somebody just joined us.
Uh-oh.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Your friend was dissing you. Ah, she's probably giving an exam somewhere.
Yes, probably. No, I finished the exam yesterday.
Good for you. We're kind of on this theme of industries we sort of want back. And the one this week was the shipbuilders. How we're down to like next to none. And I'm just trying to figure out how exactly do you bring back an industry. We have, you know, the style of the current White House. You know, and I'm sure almost was the same as the other White Houses. We got to get some huge deal we can announce with some Korean place to take over our place here. And I know Russell and I, being in the industry we're in, wait a minute, you're supposed to go to New York Stock Exchange or a bank, and we can raise that capital here. We don't need the freaking Koreans in here to do this ourselves. The whole thing is starting one of those places up from scratch, and we only have 6 shipyards left, is how do you go about doing it? And then, by the way, if it works, how many other people benefit from it? And on top of that, yesterday we got this employment report, which is pretty horrible, which is showing the economy going absolutely the other way, and we're trying to put all this stuff together, Larissa. So you can give us a plan in the next 2 minutes of how we start up shipbuilding. All of a sudden, the bars and restaurants out to those places, now they make money, and we turn this whole bus around by the end of the show. How are we going to do that?
It's interesting you bring this up. Russell and I were at the Fed Symposium this past Friday, and we heard from somebody in, was it furniture manufacturing, and then somebody in chemicals. And one of the things they're genuinely struggling with is finding talented, qualified workers. So they need skilled laborers, and they can't find them. And those that they do find, the revolving door is too high. So these people are in, and then they're out, and then they come back in. And you're not really getting that continuity within the firm that you need to really grow and have the firm thrive. So they are spending more time now building out apprentices so that people who don't have the skills can come to the firm and learn the skills that they need, so that the goal is to have that employee stay with the company for many years. And I think one of the things that has changed within our overall economy is that we don't value the trades, even though trades will sometimes make substantially more than substantially more than somebody who has a college degree. So, for example, if you work in HVAC and you're successful and doing a good job, you can make substantially more money than perhaps somebody who's gone to undergraduate and gotten a job. But I think we lack right now in our economy skilled labor.
When I bought this truck, my previous truck, I went to Grand Rapids or someplace, and I bought my Suburban up there. Not that you care about my Suburban, but they didn't open on a Saturday, right? So I said, I got to come up there. I can't come up during the week. The guy goes, I'll come in on Saturday. I'll meet you. So I have about a two-hour discussion with the guy. Imagine me talking to somebody for 2 hours, Larissa.
I can.
So if ever you want to talk to anybody in a neighborhood and find out exactly how the neighborhood's doing, talk to the guy selling used cars in the neighborhood. He absolutely knows. But driving through there, there was a little festival on the street, right? So I had to take some side streets in Grand Rapids. And I'm looking at the houses, and I'm looking, you know, these things look a little strange. Everybody's, you know, yard is nice, everything's clean, everything's decent, looks like it's painted, but all the roofs look like they needed a new one. You know, the windows needed a little shabby. So I started talking to the guy, and he goes, you know, we used to make all this industrial, you know, office furniture kind of stuff. That was the whole area up there in Michigan. He said everybody here.
I think steel cases up there.
Yeah, well, they're kind of a shadow of themselves. They might still be mm-hmm. there, but he goes, just about all these people. This was 11 years ago. He goes, all these people were making 25, 30, 35 hours an hour in making this kind of stuff. Then everybody gets laid off, whatever recession it was. He says, and now pretty much everybody's back to work, but they're making 20, 22 hours an hour at like the Walmart or Home Depot or someplace. He goes, by the way, did you drive through the neighborhood? And I go, yeah. He goes, did you spot that nobody's got a new roof? I'm like, the guy's telling me what I just noticed, you know. And then he goes, yeah, everybody's now pretty much back to work. Our unemployment rate is down to where it was, but now instead of $35 an hour, everybody's making 22.
Well, and they're no longer at that skilled labor,
right?
And I think that's the difference is we've lost a lot of that niche for the employment, and employers need skilled labor.
Well, listen, what if you had a guess? I mean, I don't know if you ever worked in a factory, but you seem like you have a sense of this. I mean, I know Pullman was a huge place. So if they hired somebody, and he supposedly was a welder, but he was a crap welder, okay, they taught the guy because they wanted the guy welding Pullman way anyway because they were very good at it. How big do you have to be, instead of just coming on TV and whining you can't get skilled people, how big do you have to be to actually have a training program where you can have three or four people that are essentially in the learning process and not go under? I mean, you got to be somewhat. I don't think you have to be 1,000 people, but you can't be 5 people either.
No, I agree. You have to be have some kind of substantial size, and we don't have educational. I don't think, in my opinion, we don't have enough educational support to develop and train those skills outside of the workforce.
But we used to. We used to teach all that stuff in the schools here, and we don't.
No, right. And I remember when I was in high school, you could go to vocational technology school, or you can stay for college prep. And about half the school went to VOTEC, and the other half stayed for college prep. I don't remember seeing I don't remember seeing VOTEC in the last 10, 15 years.
We need it more, and it's gone.
It's gone.
And I feel like it's gone because we ridiculed the people that did it.
Agreed.
Well, you know, the oddest part of it, and everybody...
all the dumb guys that were in shop, and, you know, those are the dumb guys that are running their own, you know, HVAC company now, and actually are one of the few millionaires I went to high school with.
Right.
Well, how come a guy like me, I've got all these degrees, and I really wish that I would have taken more wood shop and stuff. I mean, I love doing that kind of stuff. Does that mean, why can't you do both?
There's not enough time in your high school schedule to allow you to do both.
Well, yeah, you got to choose a track.
Well, the
competition to get in those top colleges is so intense that most high school students, if they're competing to get into an Ivy League school, they are not going to put any room in their schedule for something like shop.
I suppose. But I mean, I took wood shop at the local park district. Well, I bet they haven't done that in 40 years.
No, I don't think so.
But I mean, these are simple things. Why not, is the question.
Yeah, that's fantastic. My father took shop at the park district, and I still have a stool that he made that's almost 100 years old.
I bet it still works.
It does work.
You can still sit on it.
I'm trying to figure out which house it goes to.
Well, if a big fatso comes over, say, sit on that stool, I know it won't break.
It might.
So what's how was the semester? What's going on? Are you teaching the same stuff next time, or?
I'm going to be teaching risk management and personal finance.
Wow.
And I'm pretty excited about the personal finance. We're going to be diving a little bit more deeply into some investment topics. And my goal for my students, so if any of my students are listening, my goal for the students is on day one of their first job that they're going to be able to properly sign up for insurance and properly pick the right investments in their 401k. I feel like that is a skill set that's not necessarily taught in college, so I'm excited for this class.
Well, if you're going to teach a class on where to put my client's money next year, how can I get in?
Well, and especially, I don't know that these would be your clients, because they'd be 22-year-olds.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. So if you, out of the 50 ETFs, or maybe the 10 my people we talk about, if you could tell me the ones that are going to do well next year, I'm all in. I'll drive down there. Speaking of which, the last couple of days, but I know you guys don't like, well, what do you make of the oil market right now? I mean, there's all kinds of news. The oil's under $60, and the XLE is, actually, it's not down as much as you would think. And we have some people, and, there's a lot of people that are involved in oil stocks. Is it a buying opportunity, or shed those things like a dead dog? I'm on the fence on this.
The level that you really want to be concerned with in the oil market is like the mid-50s, because that's where shale becomes unprofitable. And that's kind of like could be an inflection point with respect to just with respect to how much supply we're getting. So typically everybody attributes like low oil prices to too much supply, but I think more of it actually comes from the demand side. And I feel like the economy is slowing around the world a little bit more than people think. And that's what's showing up in such low oil prices. But I do think the mid-50s for a lot of interested parties is kind of a floor. And when you look at some of the option activity, when you look at a put strategy that looks like it might be a hedge, there are a lot of hedges that do okay as long as we stay above 55. Like, buying a 60 put for a couple of bucks that'll be okay at 55, but you're not buying a 55 put because you don't think we're going to blow through that level. So I think we're closer to the low end than the high end on it. The geopolitical stuff and us grabbing tankers, it will probably help put a floor in the price. I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if that's a little bit of the motivation behind going after Venezuela.
Well, there was a
the oil guys are aware that we're close to the low end. What would it take to maybe make the price pop up a little bit? Geopolitical strife, especially focused on oil producing countries, for sure.
Well, we've talked. Well, we haven't done it in a long time, and listen, I hope I'm not going to bore you with this, but the pipeline that Biden canceled and Trump wanted to have it anyway, the one that went from Canada through Nebraska to get, and eventually got canceled was from the tar sands oil. Evidently, yeah. And I watch his YouTube thing, and sometimes people come with a different point of view there. they were talking about why all of a sudden, you know, the administration is so concerned with Venezuelan oil. But for those that, you know, I'm no oil engineer, but there's been enough people on the show, refineries are set up for essentially a certain type of oil, and they can't just switch. And we have this guy diagrammed like 10 refineries on the Gulf Coast and one somewhere up here. I don't know if it was Chicago, somewhere up north. Those are designed for essentially the crap oil you get out of Canada, maybe some Saudi, and Venezuela. It's kind of sludgy oil, and there's, you know, there's all kinds of crap in it, including sand. And these refineries don't have any oil, or have very little, because all the stuff that comes out of the Permian and those kinds of places is essentially light. There's heavy, medium, and light. And we have this huge oversupply now of light compared to the other. So if we could somehow find a way by hook or crook, literally, to turn on the Venezuelan oil spigot, it's going to help these particular places. Now, whether or not we're going to go to war to help these places, I'm not going to take that reach. But it seems like there is that was the reason for that. What was the name of the pipeline that we canceled? The one, I forget the name of the damn thing. But the one that wasn't going to, and everybody thought, you know, that oil was going to come to the Midwest. It wasn't, because there's no, this is way more technical than maybe most people think. And I'm just delving into it a little bit. It's pretty interesting.
I thought the pipeline was supposed to get all the way down to Louisiana.
Yeah, it was going to go from Canada. It was going to go from Canada down to these particular refineries, because the tar sands oil is similar to Venezuelan oil, evidently. Which is crap. When the oil got way down, when it went under the one night on Friday night, that stuff was like $10 or $5 a barrel in the field in British Columbia.
Keystone,
yeah. So what is the balance? Do you guys see any? I mean, Purdue obviously is renowned as an engineering school. Larissa, how many people there are taking civil engineering and mechanical engineering versus other stuff?
I have to level with you. I have no idea.
Well, I mean, obviously you've got a lot of students in the stuff you're doing. That doesn't sound like engineering.
Oh, it's not. So my major is actually in the College of Health and Human Sciences. So it is focused on, within that college, I'm in hospitality tourism management, and it's focused on well-being, which is why it's financial counseling planning is located within this, in this college. So we are nothing to do with the engineers. We also take in a lot of change of majors. So students who come to Purdue and maybe major in something else and then find that it's not right for them will end up in our major. So I don't necessarily have a sense for the engineering programs, because it's not at all in my area.
Well, if somebody takes your risk management class, does that count as a business credit?
I think the business school will allow them to count my class.
Okay.
So I'm not even housed within the business school.
Okay. Well, so who's the normal student? When you say risk management, are you talking portfolio risk, business risk, or all of the above?
So I will be teaching market risk, and then we will be discussing insurance products, and then we will round out the semester with different hedging techniques.
Wow. Well, that's a broad spectrum.
It is, but this is probably the only class that they're going to have in my major where they're going to be able to see some of these topics. So I want to take advantage of all of that. I'm also going to have the class run so that they can do modeling for all of these things. So I'm pretty excited about it.
Russell, did you have a chance? Listen, I got to get your email, because one of the listeners, been a listener for a long time, sent in something one of his friends sent him, down the line. It has to do with it's like a bunch of different people's comments on the leverage it's piling into this AI stuff. And we're back to the synthetic loan stuff, and we're back to going out for 150% of the money that you need for whatever you're putting together, your data center. And oh, by the way, we're slicing this up so it can be sold off balance sheets. Doesn't it sound like the same thing we did in 2007 and maybe what we did with railroads about 150 years ago, Russell?
Yeah, no, most definitely. I thought you were asking Larissa.
Well, yeah, I'm asking, but I mean, she didn't get the article. I sent it to you. I don't know if you had a chance to read it, but
this is something I've been talking about for a while. Is just that, how are you going to pay for all of this money that you're having to spend on the build out with AI? And one of probably the biggest red flag to me right off the bat was all of these, all of the purchasers have started extending the depreciation around the chips that they're buying. And forever they've been depreciating these things over 3 years. They are stretching it out to six. Well, computer chips don't, their useful life is not 6 years. It's just not. So, and this is what Carl was mentioning toward the end on the first hour, talking about a day of reckoning where you can't use these things anymore and you're going to have to write them off. But that's a 3, 4, or 5 year problem right now. The financing part, I just don't see how they're going to, the firms that are having to spend the money, I don't see how they're going to recoup it through revenues. And I was watching the guy from Citadel. He was speaking at a conference in Paris yesterday. And he said that he had been on a roundtable with a bunch of CEOs that were talking, and they had to answer the question, how's technology going to help your business in the next year or two? And not a single CEO talked about an AI initiative.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's from traditional industry. So, sometimes what happens in the technology space is we have a really shiny new cool thing, but we don't know how we're going to make money with it. And I that's what I think AI is.
Did you?
That's more of my problem. And I feel like the purchasers, once again, like the Microsofts of the world, they're going to start looking around at, what are we spending this money for? Where are the revenues going to come from? And you're going to hear a little bit about maybe scaling back some of the spending. That's the crack that I'm looking for right there.
Did you guys see the Merriam-Webster's Word of the Year? Yesterday came out or the day before?
I did not see this.
It's a farm word.
Slop.
Yep.
So guess what that is, Larissa? I couldn't wait to read. Digital content of low quality that is produced usually in quantity by means of artificial intelligence. It's called slop. When you're talking about the risk management, are you talking about managing a company, managing their own portfolios? I mean, it all kind of blends together, but what level are you shooting at?
My goal, it's financial planning counseling. And my goal is for individual portfolios. So we're not necessarily looking at it from a portfolio management perspective of like an ETF who's managing their portfolio. We're looking at it from the perspective of managing an individual client's portfolio, which is why the insurance products are such an important part. I'm focusing on the market risk management because I think the students need to have a firm grasp of what can happen in the market and what are some general portfolio tools for understanding tail risk. So that's why I'm starting with that before going into risk management. But so we're looking at individual portfolios.
If you were to give a test day one, with most of the people who walk in there, is there some pre-course so they at least know what a stock and a bond and a preferred stock and all that stuff is?
I'm hoping that all my students have taken the investments course, but okay. I don't know that they have. So I think they are going to be quite surprised. And we are looking to make sure that the curriculum, or we're redoing some of the curriculum mapping so that the prereqs are appropriately put in. Because again, how can you have risk management and not talk about hedging techniques?
I would agree. It's funny, whenever we talk about all these different subjects and when different people come on, all I do is remember the last ones. And on Monday, I think we were reporting, maybe it was last Friday, that when you talk about students how to manage their portfolio, the first thing that pops into my mind is let's hope to the point where they have a portfolio.
Right.
Because there was, what was the thing, Russell? You and I talked about it last Wednesday, wasn't it? The median salary in the entire retail community is about $36,500, and to rent an apartment now you need $70,000 to rent the apartment, so you're not even halfway there. And I'm sitting there going, okay, I guess these guys should know how to run a portfolio, but where's the portfolio? You look at the labor numbers yesterday and you see it's kind of strange. Did you guys look at those at all?
I did not get a chance to see them.
But I have no confidence in the numbers we're getting right now.
Well, I don't either. I just, the number that I kind of zero in on, and, you know, because Carl does this way better than me, because he looks at all the unadjusted stuff, and I just look at the idiot page, the A1 page, and it looks to me like since January, well, January is that weird month, right? We're up 2 million people almost exactly. All right, out of the 2 million people, we got maybe 2 million that are, no, from since January, we're the exact same number of people employed, actually a little less. We've got 1 million people more and unemployed, meaning they're looking for a job, and we got 1.5 million, and we don't know what they're doing. So the entire 2 million
people dropped out of the labor force?
Yeah, well, or something. That's, they might be retired. They could, you know, could be retired or be in school, but bottom line is we haven't added a job the whole year, for God's sake.
Nope.
The percentage of people working went from 60.1, which was kind of an uptick in January, down to 59.6. And I'm thinking if that number ever made it to 57, I don't care if Solomon is president. I don't see how you balance it with only 57% of the people working. And do you guys have a thought on that?
You don't. Well, you know, the ones that are working are supporting the ones that aren't. Yeah. So that will catch up with us in the long run for sure. I don't think that number is going to get any better. I think that's going to be an issue that we start to see working its way through in the first quarter. I've heard anecdotally from a couple of places that the laying people off for AI is really just an excuse.
Sure.
Yeah, and that we have been a bit overemployed for a while, maybe coming off of COVID.
Well, if you pull the, and this goes on, this is, you know, this has been the last 7-8 months. If you pull the people in the healthcare industry off the new hirees, and a lot of them aren't even doctors and nurses, it's all kind of overhead. If you pull them out, it's been a pretty awful last 18 months employment wise. I mean, it's a job, and you know they're getting paid, so there's nothing wrong with that. But it's just, it seems like kind of an odd area that's where we're heading.
Well, that's demographic.
Well, it is.
It's just the aging of America.
Well, it is.
It truly is demographic.
We had the discussion yesterday that if somebody could, I'll use the term fix, the medical area, because it's now 21% or something of the GDP. One kind of started this off, Larissa. I don't think you weren't on the week, but one of our listeners, lady, I didn't even know was a listener, sent me an email about how she was taking care of somebody with cancer. And she was asked me, you know, is it true that I can go outside the country, because the lady didn't have any insurance, and she was paying for it, which is pretty darn nice. And I had no idea, so I just toggled. I probably used AI. What does it cost to have chemotherapy in India versus here? Same stuff, allegedly. In India, it's $500 to $2,000 a pop, and here it could be anywhere from $15,000 to $50,000. And I'm sitting there going, "Wow, that is." I knew stuff was cheaper. I know people that have gone, to Thailand and gotten plastic surgery, and people going to Mexico and had dental work done. But I had no idea it was of that magnitude. And
I used to have a friend from Brazil that would go, you know, that was a U.S. citizen, but that would go back twice a year for all of those, you know, visit family, but for the dental, the eye, everything.
Well, I mean,
because even with insurance in the United States, it was cheaper to do that.
Well, and we're talking about, you know, $2,000, $2,100 somewhere for a company to pay for insurance for an employee. And so Carl and I were opining, and I said, you know, I'm going to ask Russell and Larissa if she comes on tomorrow, what if somebody by magic could cut some of these prices on these prescription drugs that are to the moon? What if that number that a company had to pay, I'm not even talking about your or my emergency room visit, could go to $1,500 a month? What would the economy look like if for every employee slash family you had, there was all of a sudden $500 more to play every month, which I think there ought to be. Now, you're probably getting some layoffs in the medical area, maybe, but can you imagine the boom it would be for everything else? I mean, I can't imagine. That's why I'm asking the question. What do you think would happen if all of a sudden every family had another $500 a month?
I can say that I know in my family we spend quite a bit on health insurance and medical. It would be it would really change the scope of the finances for my family.
Yeah, but it really would. It's almost a car payment, for God's sake.
Yeah. Well, about half a car payment.
Well, depending on the car.
Or in some cases, more than a car payment.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. If you drive what I drive, it's way more than a car payment. But I mean, these numbers have gotten so big. I mean, they're so big. I mean, even if,
yeah.
I mean, Russell and I have talked about one of my friends. I don't do tax or anything anymore. But he's on Social Security and he's got a couple of prescription drugs and he's telling me how much he's paying for all his different stuff and he's on Eliquis, right? And I think last year he paid $3,500 even with the Medicare insurance, and the total cost between him and Medicare was like $7,500. Now this product's been on the market for 15 years. I'm guessing.
Wait, and we should say that's per month, right?
No, it's for the whole year.
For the whole year, okay.
But still, $7,500 is a lot.
Sure.
I mean it's $20 a day, right? So it's, I think you take two pills, it's $10 a pill. That's a lot.
A lot.
And I'm going to say that I've read, you know, a couple guys and that give you their off the seat of the pants think that the year's worth of Eliquis costs whoever it is, Lilly or somebody, like $200 to $300. I don't see how, you know, both parties, you know, dick around with this. We're not going to pay for this insurance. We're not going to pay for this and that. I don't see wherever you get anywhere. How can you justify people paying $10 a pill for something that costs somebody one? I mean, I don't care what you do with the insurance or whatever, you know, whichever they pick, Larissa's going to teach you how to do that. But whatever you do, at the end of the day, the ball of silly putty is just too big. And I mean, I don't see why those places get all that dough when they don't deserve it and everybody else has got nothing. But anyway, it's just kind of because Carl was always talking about it, so we. But when you go through an individual person's, you know, what they pay for medical stuff, it's scary. And it's not even an emergency room visit that's, you know, $5,000 for a couple of stitches. Just, so what do you sounds like you've done some research on that, Larissa. What is the average family actually paying between the, well, they're not getting as much salary because the place is paying insurance for you, right? But then the out-of-pockets have to get bigger and bigger every year, don't they?
Yeah, the out-of-pockets can be quite big, and you know, hitting a $6,000 deductible every year on top of the insurance premiums that you're paying, and then you're out-of-pocket, because I believe you have the deductible, and then you also have to pay, and I apologize for botching this up because this is not my area, but you also have to pay some co-payments. And it can add up really quickly, especially if you have a family and you're just doing normal health stuff for your kids.
Well, it's have you ever, one of the guys in the building here, maybe this would be educational for everybody, but a good friend of mine, he's an engineer for the building. Well, he has a hernia. Well, I'll say it was a simple hernia, but it's because it wasn't on me, it was on him. You know, but it was, you know, just basically your standard hernia, right? And so he has to go in, and this is in like February. He says to me, "Oh, big guy, you got to help me with what I should do here. And I go, what are you talking about? And he says, well, my insurance has a $5,000 deductible. And wherever this guy's sending me, the surgery's like 10 grand or something. So he's got to come up with five. But there are places you can go, like these new surgical center kind of things, where they where the whole surgery is like 2,500 or 3 grand for the total off the top. And I said, he goes, what should I do? You know what, guys? What I should have done is pass the problem on to you two. I could not figure out what he should do. I sit there and go, if it was, you know, the last week in December, I would say go get the other guys for 3 grand. But since it's February, what if you go to the other place and you pay the 3 grand and now something happens next week, your kid playing soccer breaks an ankle or something, now you're still stuck with this $5,000 deductible you got to pay. I could not help the guy with all my education. I said it's a toss-up. As a matter of fact, I think you're probably almost better off paying the 5. But I should have sent it to you guys. I mean, those are the kinds of decisions that were Larissa, when you talk about the insurance stuff, selecting it, do you go through all that?
I'm hoping to.
Yeah.
I don't know that.
There's a great case study for you right there.
Yeah.
Or a discussion in class right there.
Right.
I mean, I never even dreamed of such a thing. And I'm sitting there going, okay, I've got all this alleged education. I couldn't help the guy out. I said, you know, it looks like kind of a toss-up. Do you think nobody's going to get sick for the next 10 months? I mean, if you're going to take that bet, you're better off paying the guy just to do it. But what if somebody is hurt tomorrow? You're right back where you started from.
Well, you're actually even worse than where you started
yeah.
from.
Yeah. I mean, these insurance companies are pretty bright, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
So what are students asking you guys? What's the question of the day?
Oh, how can I get an A in this class?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's the end of your semester and I'm on break.
Yeah. My students are asking very different types of questions. Will I pass?
Well, I'll rephrase. Russell, when you're heading down and you're in the car with a couple of people that you ride down with, Indiana, what's the discussion in the car about from the economist?
Well, the person the person I rode in the car with now works at Purdue.
Okay.
So what have we been talking about, Larissa?
Well, let's see. We have been talking about, always talk about CPI. But we've yeah. also been talking about the challenges of basically the K economy. And we've been discussing things such as, we've been talking about...
Okay, define the K economy. Let everybody know what the K economy means.
So the K economy is when you have this two groupings of people within the economy. You've got one section that's doing substantially well, so it's the top part of the K going upwards, and then you have another part of the subset of people, and they're economically they're going down. And the expression on Friday was that 10% of the population was doing 90% of the spending, and I don't know if that's accurate or if that was just something that was being tossed around, but this idea that there is a substantial amount of discrepancy between these two groups of people, and how when you start to aggregate some of these numbers up, it really makes it look like the economy is doing well, even though for a lot of people it's not.
Is there any way you can... We've mentioned that, by the way, nowhere near as articulately as you just did. I mean, what do you do if the retail sales number across the board are, you know, they're down 3%, say, for every man, yet three guys go out and buy a super yacht or something, and all of a sudden the gross numbers are higher, even though... Is there any delineation of that somewhere, or can you figure that out?
Yeah, through the specific retailers.
Okay.
And we look at Target and Walmart versus each other, and how the spending and the stock performance shift, you know, is pretty interesting around recessions. That, you know, people that load up on their Diet Cokes and all that kind of stuff from Target maybe make a visit or two to Walmart when they're a bit more concerned around their professional or personal finances. So yeah, you can pick up on it when you look at the spending at certain level retailers, But the funny thing is, you know, you're seeing questionable numbers out of retailers like Target and Walmart on a monthly basis, you know, as it, that make you question the economy. But then when you look at the high end ones, there ain't any problems at, you know, Tiffany's.
Nope.
Everybody's still always spending there. So, and I think that's how you demonstrate the K economy.
Well, how do you break through?
Walmart's benefiting because one end is very concerned. Tiffany's is benefiting because there's an end that's never concerned.
Well, and it's funny you should say that. My dissertation advisor would always say that when the economy goes bad, he then invests in Neiman Marcus. He says they never do poorly. It doesn't matter what's going on in the economy. Those people are still spending.
Well, it's kind of an unusual economy so far. Oh, boy, I use that term loosely. In that the wealth stuff, if you own, you're still making money every month. We're almost at all-time highs in the market. So if you're a salaried bloke, as they would say in Australia, the world might not be so hot for you. But if daddy left you, you know, 50,000 shares of Google or something, you're having a great year, right? I mean, so there's kind of a bifurcation there. Is there any way in your, because you guys have, you know, a lot of history behind you, not that you're old or anything, but can this come together not violently? I keep thinking that it can. Carl and a few other people say there's no friggin' way that it's going to have to be a 1929 fiasco where all of a sudden the market comes flying down someday and that part comes, you know, the matchup that inevitably has to happen will be somewhat violent. I keep thinking maybe we can grow into it, or maybe it wouldn't be so violent, or something. What do you guys think of that? Is it, because clearly there's two. I mean, Larissa, the question is, can the K's keep going, or one goes below zero and one goes to the moon, or is there some place they got to kind of bend together?
So I'm not sure, but I do know that we have a lot of new tools and techniques, and we've learned a lot since the 1929 crash. So I believe that because of that, the government will step in, and even if we have a crash, it won't be nearly as severe as one of the crashes that we had in 1929. Now, I could be very wrong on that. I thought the crash in 2008 was pretty severe. And I know that discussion at the time was it could have been a lot worse. But that was a pretty bad crash.
It was. The response was to throw money at it.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've been kind of throwing money at it sort of for a while. If it happens again tomorrow, is that still the solution? In other words, if the market drops 30%, can the Fed just, you know, print $1 trillion and make it all right? I mean, I don't know about that. That would be their first response, I would think, because they've done it so many times. But, you know, I don't know. Do you think at some point, is it? That's what I'm asking the question. If I knew the answer, I would just say the answer, but I don't. Is that what other do you think they can do? It doesn't seem like they have any idea about the leverage and what's going on with the AI stuff. I would think, and I'm guessing Russell would agree with me, that even though it would be very unpopular, if we were head of the Fed right now, I wouldn't be adverse at all to raising the margin requirement on stock to 55 or 60%, given what the market's doing. I mean, I don't see any kind of leadership like that anywhere. Do you guys? I mean, I don't.
They're not going to do anything that's going to threaten asset prices. You know that.
Well, my question is...
What they should do and what they will do are two very different things. And it's, you know, they used to be Congress and the Fed, and now the they is just the Fed, and that's the problem. Right there. That the fiscal side, you know, it's like... You got a house. You know what? I'm going to use the White Lotus example with Parker Posey, who says she can't really lead. She was not meant to lead an uncomfortable life, and she was married to a hedge fund guy. And it felt like, you know, part of what was going on was the hedge fund guy was just killing himself all the time to maintain the lifestyle for the spender. You know, so you've got somebody that's bringing a lot of the money in and continues to bring, you know, to figure out where to get the money. And that's the Fed that's doing the work. And I'm going to say that Congress is Parker Posey from White Lotus and not willing to live an uncomfortable life at all, even though it's the fiscally responsible thing to do. So that's the entity that I really feel like is screwing everything up, not the Fed. I feel like the Fed's doing the best they can with the cards that they were dealt.
Well, they're playing along.
I don't feel like the you know, taxing and spending side is holding up their side of the bargain, and they haven't for a long time.
Well, but they could, if they wanted. And this is not a recommendation. Do you realize that the two of you just gave totally different answers to their question?
Yeah.
Larissa says that they have more tools at their disposal, and you said, yeah, but they're never going to use them.
Well, I didn't say they weren't going to use them. I was going to say they shouldn't, but it's yeah, I feel like, you know, the other side of the equation needs to get taken care of, and that's impossible because, you know, apparently, you know, Trump came in, they're gonna cut spending. I think that net out, they didn't really cut any spending.
Last month was the biggest net deficit in the history of the country.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what?
I think it's beyond fixable.
And Russell, I really liked your example.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed your example from White Lotus.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. Well, so I got to write that down so I remember it.
Larissa, and sort of on the same note, one of my buddies, he's been on the show a couple times, Jan Lee. At his wedding, I was in the wedding party, right? So Audrey had to go out and sit with the rest of the people, which is fine because Audrey can talk to anybody. So she's sitting with a few of the guys who are in the consulting business, them and their wives. And one of the ladies starts talking about, well, you know, I'm never going to go near the J word. You know, Audrey's trading on the trading floor. Audrey's been a blue collar girl. She's always worked. And finally, at some point, she goes, what exactly is the J word? And the lady goes, well, that means a job. I'm never going to have a job. that's why we married these guys. We're never going to have a job. And she's looking at him like they had five heads. Audrey always had a job. She's like, they never want one, or they're like out on the marriage type of thing. I'm sitting there, well, that's a little harsh. But, you know, whatever. If you can pull it off, I guess it works, right? If you're a trust fund baby, you never have to work. Anyway. But, I mean, it is... These are sort of interesting times, and the odd part, Russell, as you mentioned about the Fed, there's a really good article here. I should scan it and send it to you guys, but it's kind of basic economics. If you're gonna, which of course you know, you guys know, but if you're gonna spend more money next year as a government, not as a city, but because you got to balance, as a government, you can do three things. You can A, increase the taxes, which is unpopular. Two, you can borrow it because you're going to spend it, then you got to pay it back, or you can just print it. And the Fed is at the basic crux of this. They could, if you had somebody that had the balls enough or had the power enough, you could say, all right, guys, you're going to spend $20 billion more than you're taking in next year. You better either tax it or you better borrow it because I'm not helping you. Theoretically, that's how we're set up. But like Russell says, that's never going to happen because it's all part of the same political. But you could, the Fed could do that, right? I mean, theoretically, but they never have.
They could, yeah. I mean, they could cut it off, or they could make it more expensive for the government to borrow. Can you imagine the absolute meltdown that our current president would have if they started talking about raising rates right now?
Well, I mean, at some point...
Which there is an argument for that.
Well, how are we going to make it, I won't say 3 years, the next year, how the hell are we going to make it without some sort of a tax increase? I mean, I don't want it. I know the listeners don't want it, but look at the numbers, guys. I mean, for God's sake.
Yeah. Something's got to give in one direction or another.
Yeah, And what is that going to do to the market? It's reaching a point
where.
Well,
and the problem is what the big cycle here is. Okay, let's say we get in the thing that Larissa and I attended last week. One of the my big takeaway from it was the first quarter of 2026 is going to be a big freaking deal. That a lot of the work that the Fed has done, they expect to you know, show up in the numbers in the first quarter. And, you know, if we get any hint of inflation, the cutting is done. And if we get, you know, if let's say we end up in the upper threes with inflation, you're going to be looking at a hike next year. And our stock market is based on the whole idea that the Fed is going to constantly be making money cheap. If they lose that ability, that's going to result in a pretty difficult situation for the stock market. We end up in a difficult situation for the stock market. Market sells off. We end up in a bit of a panic. What does the Fed do to fix it? They give us more money.
Well,
it's a bad cycle.
That's kind of what they're doing. We're going back and buying bills, right?
I mean, they're doing it right now, and that's the other thing is I hate that they use some of the bullets when I don't really feel like they need to.
Well, I think their job right now in their mind is to keep the market up.
And that's not their job.
No, but it's. I think
they have a dual mandate.
Do you think they're getting some pressure to do that, though?
Oh, I'm sure they are.
Larissa, one of the things I remember from Milton Friedman's class is that when inflation starts, it starts to feel so good. It's like your first beer. But problem is, it starts to feel so good that you keep it going, and all of a sudden it's a disaster. He goes, that's why you can never let it start. That was, yeah. You know, that was 50 years ago, for God's sake. And now it has started. I mean, we have, you know, I can't say as a genius on this because I was early. We have a real lot of people that are over allocated in gold and silver. And for a couple of years, we were chasing the market. Now, all of a sudden, the last 6 months, we're making money every day for people. I mean, I can't dream that these things are going up this high. And yet, they keep going. I mean, it's insanity that gold is up here and silver is up here. And yet, I asked Russell last week, I don't know if we're just, it seems awful high to me, and we're keeping our puts close. But if these guys start pumping 8-10% money supply every year, we might just be starting. How scary is that, Russell? I mean, this is nuts.
Yeah, that's kind of an understatement, isn't it?
Yeah. So you guys are off to when? When you start kind of the same time, or are one of you guys quarter and one semester? Are you both the same?
Oh my gosh.
Russell's on different schedules.
You're at, what are you guys? We were semester at Notre Dame. What are you guys?
I'm semester.
Russell, you guys
are both.
You're both.
Yeah, I'm semester for undergrad and quarter for graduate.
Okay.
Yeah, it sounds a lot easier than it is.
Well, yeah, which are you doing most of? You were doing all graduate for a while, right?
No, somebody left Kelly, and I've got to pick up some undergraduate classes in the spring. Thank you, Dr. Ademiak.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, he picked up my classes.
Well, you know. Is he doing as good a job as you did, you think?
Oh, I think he's going to do a much better job than I did.
Well, I think we both have similar strengths and weaknesses, or different strengths and weaknesses. How's that?
Well, I tell you what, I think the guys that are taking classes from you guys, I mean, Russell, the people who you teach in the grad level have any idea of your expertise?
I'm not really good at self-promotion or anything. I think they figure it out as the quarter goes along.
Oh, I think they thoroughly enjoy listening to your stories and your insights and what you've done and things like that. I think they take what you say about the markets very seriously, and I think they pay quite a bit of attention because you've actually lived it. And I think that's one of the things that really separates Russell from a lot of other finance faculty members.
But when he makes a comment on VIX, does everybody know that he's written like the best books on it of anybody? I mean, there's a lot behind the comment.
Well, I think that a lot of students, as soon as he starts talking, look him up and say, oh my goodness. And so I think a lot of that happens in the beginning of his semesters as well.
Maybe I should look him up under AI. What do you think it'd tell me?
It's a pretty interesting answer.
Imagine it is. Hey guys, we are going to be on next week and the week after if you guys are around Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve. I hope you are. The Christmas on a Thursday is a little odd, but
yeah.
So we're just, I mean, if you guys are around, let me know if you're not, but I hope you will be. Who knows? We might have some stuff to talk about, right? We never seem to run out of stuff to talk about, do we?
No. It never ends.
Oh, God, it never ends. But so happy shopping and happy whatever else, and hopefully we will talk next week. Nice job, Andrew, even though we didn't do any breaks. By the way, the S&P futures are up 20, NASDAQ futures up 95. The big news is silver's up like 4%, which is bizarre. It's up, it's like 65 hours. Are you guys going to start melting down your parents' sterling at this point or what?
Oh, the Rhodes silver was not really silver.
Ah. What was it?
I took it. I actually took it to do that, and they're like, "Man, this is plated, man. What you inherited crap."
Jeez. And there's a shot to the parents, Larissa. God. Anyway, thank you guys. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
Thank you.
That's all, folks.